Well, joining us on the show right now is Dr. Kanta Ahmed. She's a physician, nonfiction author, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the book, The Land of Invisible Women. She's on because she has a brand new article called Outlawing Islamophobia Would Help Jihadis in the UK, Spectator. Dr. Ahmed, thanks so much for joining the Ben Shapiro Show.
Thank you so much, Ben. A privilege.
So let's start with this. What exactly is your personal background? How did you become such a hot button figure, particularly in the Islamic community?
I think it all began on September 11th, which I witnessed in Riyadh, where I was working at the time as a physician. And at that time, our worlds were changed permanently. I was probably slightly younger than you are now. And it caused me to ask the question, what is happening to my religion that it has become weaponized into an instrument of terror? It wasn't anything that I'd ever encountered. I'd been a very monastic academic physician, so my thoughts were never involved in the politics of Islam. And that raised the question that led to me writing my book and then beginning to write opinion pieces, which people would always say, could you write about Saudi Arabia? Could you write about women? And in the course of this, I started to learn about the ideology underpinning in those days Al-Qaeda. And that led me very rapidly to the number one target of Islamists, which is, of course, the State of Israel. And I began to learn about Hamas and later about Hezbollah. That actually led me to start visiting Israel and begin understanding what Islamism, the imposter, the fictional invented Islam that fueled so much of the hostilities that we have around the world in many places, claiming more Muslim lives than anything else, as well as non-Muslim lives, and the role of being a Muslim today. We either renounce it and we condemn it and we expose it, or if we are silent, we are aiding and abetting and we are complicit. And really everything that I've written since then has always been to distinguish Islamism from Islam. That's really about it.
Dr. Ahmed, what do you think is the constituency for Islamism? So you've mentioned, obviously, the opposition to Israel in large swaths of the Muslim world. I've done videos where I estimate, based on poll numbers, how many people believe in a fundamentalist form of Islam that believes in really radical things, including the suppression of women. But maybe I'm overestimating. What do you think is the breakdown in terms of population? If you had to ballpark it, what percentage of global Muslims believe in some form of Islamism, and how many are moderate or reform Muslims?
Right. So it's an excellent question. I don't have the answer, but I will tell you some of the world's biggest countries in the Muslim majority world are governed by Islamist pseudo-democracy. My family originated in India and then took shelter in what was supposed to be the Muslim Zion, Pakistan, which is really governed now by Islamism. Iran is an Islamist pseudo-democracy. Turkey is rapidly turning into an Islamist dictatorship and really destroying so much wonderful work that was laid in the 20th century in secular Kemalism, that was the world's first Muslim democracy in one sense. I don't think it is about the numbers of Muslims in the world. We number 1.67 billion. It is about the governments that enforce policies, enforce laws, and have revived a new form of Islam, which really did not exist. They claim it to be an authentic version. And that began with the 1979 revolutionary Iran. So if you're one of the 192 million Muslims in Pakistan, you are going to be influenced by the laws, for instance, the blasphemy laws, by the laws which empower honor killings or forced marriages or child marriages. And you will not know that is absolutely in distinction to what Islam teaches. And the reason that happens is Muslims are illiterate, many times literally in their own language, let alone the classical Arabic in which the Quran is written. Muslims are not reading the Quran in translation. And then they also have a general lack of awareness of what the spirit of Islam is. With the 1979 Iranian revolution, the Khomeini regime, the Shia Islamists, brought in a newly created form of Islam. They began stoning anybody that they thought was deviant, that they thought was a disagreeable threat to them. They introduced harsh punishments which 500 years of Ottoman rule had not recorded. Murdering people who identify as gay, murdering people who decide they need to leave the religion of Islam or they question Islam. Right now we have in Pakistan a Fulbright scholar, Junaid Hafiz, in prison for being a free thinker on a death sentence for blasphemy. This did not exist in Islam. If you refer to the Quran, for instance, it is not even clear, the Quran says, whether refusing to believe or choosing to leave the belief is a prosecutable crime by a human being. If God decides that a crime, that is for the maker to judge the mortal. It is not for something to be given an earthly punishment. So we are so far moved in my lifetime, within 40 years from what Islam truly was, and it is enforced by very powerful governments, that whether there's a vast majority of the population going with it or not is almost immaterial. Now, I've lived in the Muslim world. I've traveled 47 years to the Muslim world. And I meet many ordinary, God-fearing, very decent people. I've met also with the Muslim minority communities in Israel, who, by the way, are the most sheltered Muslim minority communities in the Middle East. Muslims who are persecuted in Pakistan thrive in Israel. So I have seen a very wide array of the Muslim world, from Morocco all the way through to India and of course, Iraq and other places. So I do not see a fanaticism or a fundamentalism coursing through the vast Muslim majority population. But I see very problematic governments who normalize very distorted and brutal and inhumane versions of what I term an invented Sharia, which is then imposed on the public. And that's absolutely, I regard that as a crime against God.
And Dr. Ahmed, the push for outlawing Islamophobia, obviously this has taken place in the West in the aftermath of the Christchurch terrorist attack on Muslims. There's been an attempt to crack down on so-called Islamophobia. It seems like there's been a conflation between criticism of Islamism and targeting of Muslims themselves. Is there a line to be drawn? How do we draw a line between so-called Islamophobia and actual anti-Muslim bigotry?
So you put that very well. The use of Islamophobia, it's an attractive phrase. It sounds like homophobia. Every decent person would condemn that, myself included. But Islamophobia was a word that really came into the vernacular with the post-Iranian revolutionary era. The first charge, essentially, of Islamophobia was on Salman Rushdie on Valentine's Day 1989 for his book Satanic Verses. It became intolerable to the Ayatollah Khomeini that book existed. And he issued a lethal religious edict that the author and anyone associated with the book was it now eligible for a death penalty. The publishers, the translators were murdered. Publishing houses were burnt down. Booksellers were targeted. Salman Rushdie was sent into hiding. That was the first act of Islamophobia. And we take that from then until if you think of Charlie Hebdo in January 2015 in Paris, where cartoonists were slaughtered because of their creative expression of equal opportunity profanity. They defamed many religions as a form of their satirical expression. The West, in the face of this Islamophobia, instead of saying, look, living in a pluralistic world means that we need to live side by side with profanity. We have in our society both the sacred and the profane. We don't have to participate in either if we don't wish to. Instead, they were cowed. Now, I want to be very clear. I found the Christchurch attack devastating, as I would and as I did the attack on the Pittsburgh synagogue, where 11 Jews also were murdered in an act of hate. All forms of xenophobia are despicable and should be prosecuted, and any decent democracy will do that. That is very different than criminalizing the scrutiny, the inquiry, the criticism, the examination of Islam or Islamism or Islamic institutions or people or anything that comes out should be subject, and indeed it is a democratic right to make that inquiry. What is happening now, and it started with the Ayatollah, is that these two very distinct concepts, one is a crime in a democracy, lethal xenophobia, one is a democratic right, the right for intellectual inquiry, even if it means ridicule. These have been conflated. And it's moving very rapidly, Ben. There was a march here in New York City on Sunday, Stand United Against Islamophobia. I just heard about it from someone. Looking at the list of sponsors, many of them are Muslim Brotherhood front groups. We've had the Secretary General of the United Nations come out and say, we need to act more strongly against Islamophobia, not understanding the complete conflation. And it wasn't until a governor in Pakistan, Governor Salman Taseer, he was the Rupert Murdoch of Pakistan, stood up for a Christian peasant woman in Pakistan who was falsely accused of blasphemy and sitting on death row facing a death sentence. This Muslim governor said these blasphemy laws are absolutely inhumane and un-Islamic. This woman is innocent. We need to repeal these laws. He was executed by his own security detail for Islamophobia. Only that act slowed down the United Nations resolutions, which are always condemning Islamophobia, because the OIC, the Organization for Islamic Conference, the countries that is led by Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, they want to render Islamophobia not just something despicable or contemptible, but actually a human rights violation. If that follows through, you and I can't have this conversation because we will be accused of human rights violation. And I'm very worried about that. Since my article was published, I think, on Wednesday, the Labour Party in London, which, as you know, is rife with anti-Semitism and a very virulent form of anti-Semitism, has just adopted an official definition of Islamophobia, which has no correlation with reality. They are condemning anything that offends or hurts perceived Muslimness. That's their word. That is such a slippery slope. We had it here in this country, and I know your news agency has been reporting on this. Ilhan Omar, she is a virulent anti-Semite. Not only does she say anti-Semitic things, she fundraises for Muslim Brotherhood organizations that have at their heart an Islamist brand of anti-Semitism. And instead of making her a pariah in the Democratic Party, they circled their wagons and then they proceeded to pass a resolution rendering anti-Semitism equivalent to Islamophobia. They trivialized anti-Semitism while they endanger the speech. I, as a pluralistic Muslim observing Islam, and you as an intellectual, want to engage in. This is so dangerous. 2-3 steps and there's going to be a law. And that confines freedom of speech, freedom of thought. And we cannot have that here.
And Dr. Ahmed, final question for you. What are your hopes for the future of the moderation and reform inside Islam? Because obviously this is this is something that has to happen from the inside. Pressure from the outside isn't going to cut it, and neither are platitudes from world leaders who simply keep repeating things like Islam is a religion of peace. That may be true, but it doesn't really matter when George W. Bush says it, or Barack Obama says it, or Donald Trump says it. It only matters when active Muslims start saying it and start convincing their fellow Muslims of this.
It's not enough to say that Islam is a religion of peace, which I do believe that. We must demonstrate that in our actions. And at the moment, there are so many Islamist groups that are either engaged in evolutionary jihadist ideology, whether it's Hamas, ISIS, Hezbollah. I think right now Hamas is engaged in exactly this these deadly acts. But my hopes are actually currently very, very low. And that is because I think the hopes that could be for an enhancement and enlightenment amongst the expression of modern day Islam are held really in the secular, democratic, pluralistic world that we move in the United States, in Britain, in Western Europe. But what I see here is something very different happening. What I see here is that Muslims that are often born here, I mean in the United States, are being raised and inculcated, not necessarily by their family, but by the political climate that teaches them an acquired sense of victimhood. I have a great difficulty recognizing any Muslim in the United States to be conceivably a victim, because we have more political and more economic and other opportunities in this nation than we do have anywhere in the Muslim majority world. And yet this appetite for victimhood, that is what was in action when Nancy Pelosi and her party circled around Ilhan Omar. Chuck Schumer's words were, we don't want her singled out. This is happening on a national level. There is a militancy in the expression or the political expression of Muslims that is linking in an unholy alliance with far left ideology. So someone like me, I'm not a reformer. I'm just a Muslim living her life. But someone like me is viewed with suspicion and has been attacked as a Islamophobic, as a cause of Christchurch, or a horrible term somebody just used towards me recently, an expression that they called me a house Muslim, which I gather is a racist slur.
Yep.
Somebody like me is being demonized because we're actually talking about the real Islam, because those Muslims that are in the West with all these freedoms are actually entrenching in the Islamist ideology, the peddled victimhood that so helps Islamism advance in the West. If you think it's not advancing, I do believe the two female congresswomen that are in power now who are Muslims demonstrate a lot of Islamist sympathies, not just the anti-Semitism of Ilhan Omar, but their absolute endorsement of the boycott, divestment, sanction movement, which I regard as a militantly anti-Semitic movement, which is masquerading as a human rights group. So that's very, very concerning. And just came back from Canada last weekend, where I met with Canadian parliamentarians who informed me point blank there are 7 elected Islamists in Canada.
Wow.
So if you think that I'm dabbling in conspiracy theory, I am not. But if your viewers could maybe pick up a work of fiction, I suggest you read Michelle Holbeck's book in translation, Submission, or read it in French if you're able to access it in French. And that is one of several works in France where they imagine a Muslim Brotherhood person reaching power in French government. The fiction is often expressing the deepest fears of society. And those fears are not unfounded, because right now there isn't a person in Congress who can challenge Ilhan Omar. There isn't anyone in Congress with my voice who will be able to confront her in that way, because they are going to immediately be labeled as a racist or a bigot. And that is what's happened. Is to paraphrase Salman Rushdie, is nowadays to criticize the militant stridency of the expression of what Muslims say is Islam, when it's actually Islamism, is to be practicing bigotry. And that's why I don't feel hopeful.
Well, Dr. Ahmed, I really appreciate all the work that you're doing. And obviously, I wish you all the best luck. And we will be here to help you every step that we can. Thanks so much for joining the show. Really appreciate it.